Create My Independence podcast, episode number 44. Welcome to the Create My Independence podcast. My name is Craig Mathias, and this is the podcast devoted to creating more independence in your life through good financial habits and strategic entrepreneurship. That's right, I believe that living below our means and building a business of our own is the best way to create freedom, options, and independence in our lives so that we can do what matters to us. This week, we are back with another guest on the show. And this is a guest that I've actually wanted to have on the show for, well, basically since the show started over a year ago. Jim Collins from jlcollinsnh.com. So I thought about it after this, after the interview here, recorded about an hour ago. I've been thinking, man, Jim is like my father figure for personal finance. I think I relate to the way he does things, and I think I look to this guy for wisdom. He's got wisdom. He's got wisdom as far as kind of how to go through your career, building up money, building up a good financial position, what he calls FU money, or in the episode, he actually uses the swear word, so be advised that there are some swear words in this episode. Jim is a guy that throughout his career always wanted to have FU money so he could take a step away from something that when he got sick of it. You know what? That's his definition of FU money is like my definition of independence, and that's what Create My Independence is all about. It's Create My Independence or Create My FU money. You know, same thing. So either way, this is about an hour and 10 minutes, hour and 15 minutes here. Great stuff. We cover really some basically philosophical kind of stuff like living life, you know, what it means to be able to have FU money, what it does for your life. Is it okay to take risks, you know, and maybe try to start your own business or just take time off from work, even knowing that maybe you damage your, you know, your resume by doing that. And then at the end of this episode, probably about halfway through, actually, we get into investing. And I really kind of pick Jim's brain and ask him for personal advice. You know, for me, I'm getting married soon, got some money stashed away, and I wanted his advice on what to do with it. So if you're in any of these positions where maybe you're thinking about taking some time off from your career to kind of reflect, maybe you're sick and tired of it, maybe you don't have any FU money, but you want to save some. Or maybe in a position like me where you do have a bunch of FU money, but you don't really know what to do with it. Either way, this episode is going to be great for you, and I'm not going to waste any more time because, like I said, the interview is an hour and 10 minutes, hour and 15 minutes already. So here it is. Enjoy the interview. All right, welcome Jim Collins from jlcollinsnh.com. It's an honor to have you here.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Let's see. So what I'd like to talk about, Jim, today is obviously investing because you're the investing guy. But I'd also like to just kind of get your feedback on even my situation and help me figure out what to do because I know you're, and I know your position, and I want you to kind of talk me into why I should follow it.
You know, it's one of the one of the basic tenets that I have in my blog is I'm not there to persuade anybody of anything. I just talk about what's worked for me and what's kicked me in the ass and what I tell my daughter. Yeah, and if anybody like wants to come along for the ride, and I'm continually surprised that some people do, that's great. But
how old is your daughter, Jim? How old is your daughter?
She's 23 now. She just had a birthday.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So
we can kind of relate because I'm not far off from your daughter. I'm about 7-8 years older than her, I guess.
Yeah, and that's a big 7 or 8 years in terms of career and the little bit I know about your situation where you managed to get yourself financially and professionally. And by the way, kudos for that. It's pretty impressive.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's go ahead and tell the listeners a little bit about you. You're very successful kind of guy, and you're very financially smart. So I'd love to share that a little bit, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, go ahead. What do you want me to do?
All right. All I know about you is you're Jim Collins. You are the investing man, and you know, you can take it from there.
Well, I am Jim Collins. Whether I am the investing man or not, I think is up to the judgment of the people listening and who read the blog. And I kind of don't know where to begin with your question. I'm probably older than a lot of people who are going to be listening to this, which is to say I'm in my mid-60s and older than most of the people who read my blog. And consequently, I'm retired, but it's not unusual at my age. And mm-hmm. I think one of the things that is unusual, at least in the context of the audience my blog talks to and that presumably will be listening to this, is that when I was coming up, there was, of course, no internet. There were no computers, and for that matter, and there was no concept, at least in my head, of early retirement. I mean, it just wasn't a concept I was aware of, or even financial independence. And as anybody who is following the path even today knows, that it makes you the odd one out. Most people, most Americans are actively pursuing the traditional American dream of spend every penny you have, and tragically in some cases, then some. And that was certainly the case back in the day. So I really had no concept of achieving financial independence as a thing or early retirement. And I liked my career. I had a great career. The concept I did have, however, was having fuck you money, yeah. Which in my mind wasn't financial independence. It was just having enough money that if I didn't want to work someplace, if I got to the point where I didn't want to work someplace or I simply wanted to go do something else for a while, I could. It was freedom. So I stepped away from a lot of jobs during my career for anywhere from a few months to, I think the longest was 5 years, but it was always with the intention I was going to go back because I enjoyed my career. It was just, I guess the way to say it is I liked working. Mm-hmm. I just liked to have to do it all the time. Yeah. my psychology is a little screwy in that when I am working, I tend to be a bit of a workaholic. And I actually have a post on my blog. It was one of the earliest ones I did about my short attention span and looking back at my career. And I stayed in jobs longer than 4 years and sometimes shorter, but basically my attention span is about 4 years and then I burn myself out, but it's a great 4 years. And at that point, I always needed to take a break of some sort and do something else. So that's what investing having what I called fuck you money and what's more commonly called financial independence now meant to me, but it was never particularly about retiring.
Well, I think we have a lot in common because I think I'm very similar in that I don't really know that I want to stop working. I enjoy working, but I just want that freedom to be able to step away if it burns me out. And maybe I'm like you, Jim, that I get burnt out every 4 years too. That could be.
Yeah, well, and I think there are, I look back at my colleagues in my career, and there were some who successfully worked year in, year out for 30 plus years, and God bless them. So I think that's certainly possible. But I also noticed that they tended to work at a pace that was not as intense as the pace that I worked at. And that's not a value judgment or a criticism. In fact, there were many times I looked at it and said, I would be better off if I was more able to pace myself. Different people have different needs. And I think one of the cool things about today's environment is that's more recognized. And there are more, for those people who are willing and have the courage to go after it, there are many, many more options in terms of, when I was, again, for most of my career, I was very much the odd one out doing this. Mm-hmm. But now, so when I would step away, especially for longer than a few months, I would have to figure out some way to creatively fill that hole in my resume. I think now, people say, oh, wow, you did something cool. That's kind of neat. You know, what you stopped your career to ride your motorcycle around the world? Wow, tell me about, you know, you're an interesting kind of guy we'd like in our organization. But
so you did that throughout your entire career.
Sorry?
You did that throughout your entire career. You kind of just stepped away here and there. And is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just, and there was no particular pattern to it. As they say, sometimes, you know, I worked in Oregon, not necessarily the same job, because that helped if I had different jobs in an organization. I think the longest I stayed with any given organization was 11 years, 10, 11 years, something like that.
That's really interesting. So what did you do when you were away?
Well, it depends on the times that I was away. Sometimes we travel. The time I was away the longest, I stepped away to with the objective of buying a business.
Mm.
And that's actually kind of an interesting story in that it's the story of failure. So I was in the magazine publishing business, business-to-business magazines. And at one point, for a variety of reasons I won't bore the listeners with, I decided, and I had some contacts who encouraged me to go out and try to buy some magazines. And so I did. And it was an interesting process and a, you know, meeting with venture capitalists and lining up backing for all that kind of stuff. And looked at a lot of deals and came close on a couple, but nothing ever came together. Hmm. And about 3 years into it, I would say, I began to realize that it wasn't going to happen. And my enthusiasm for making it happen was dropping. But at the same time, having done this, I met an enormous number of interesting people. And people started asking me to do consulting work. And initially I said, no, I'm kind of stupid at times. And because my thinking was, well, I didn't start out, you know, this is not what my intention was. I never set out to be a consultant. And I didn't want it to get in the way of the objective. But as the objective became less and less important, I started accepting some of the assignments. And then after about 5 years, so maybe 3 years of really intensely trying to get a deal done, unsuccessfully, as they say, and then maybe 2 years where the priority slowly became more and more the consulting, I was calling on a guy about doing some consulting work, and he said, you know, I don't want to hire you as a consultant, but you want to be a publisher again. And so I share that story because I a lot of the comments I get on the blog in terms of people pursuing independence and doing what they want with their lives have a lot of fear in it. Yeah. And the truth is, in America, the penalty for failure, as long as you get back up, is zero. I mean, you think about this, you know, what was my penalty? And I failed. Let's be blunt about it. You know, it was a great experience. I have no regrets. I learned a ton, but I didn't accomplish what I set out to accomplish. I failed. Mm-hmm. So what's the penalty of failure? Well, I lost some pretty nice income for a number of years. And at the end of the day, I wound up with a job that was paying me more than the job I left. Yep. I mean, it's as penalties go, it ain't bad. And it might have worked, you know. Not one of the things that bothers me a little bit is you know, the world is filled with stories of people who do this and it works out wonderfully well for them. You know, Bill Gates drops out of Harvard and becomes the richest man in the world. You know, but that doesn't happen. People don't always succeed. And I think it's important for people to realize that's okay.
Yep.
On my manifesto on the blog, I have a quote that is one of my all-time favorites. It's from Leo Burnett, who was founded a big advertising agency back in the 50s or 60s or something. And the quote goes, if you reach for a star, you might not get one, but you won't come up with a handful of mud either. And that's been my experience. I've never candidly gotten the star, but I've never come up with a handful of mud. And the and the journey's been fun, and it's worked out pretty well. So I think people should be a lot less afraid of failure, even, you know, even if you think it's going to happen. As the only time it really hurts you is if you stop getting up again.
Yep.
And of course, then the game's over.
Wow, that's cool. I agree with everything you said there too. Wow. So
yeah, I see. You know, you're an interesting case, and not that I know that much about what you're doing, but mm-hmm. I do know that you stepped away from your workaday job without being fully financially independent.
Yep.
And in my mind, my way of thinking, you had fuck you money, which means you had enough money that you didn't have to worry about paying the rent, but not enough money necessarily to never work again. So it buys you a chance to try to do something different and interesting, and who knows where it'll go. I mean, it mm-hmm. Maybe it goes nowhere, you know, maybe you wind up with another job, but that's the worst case scenario, and it just ain't that bad. You will have had a great experience, you will have learned a ton, and you'll be a more interesting human being for it.
And then
there's a possibility that it will explode on the upside. So why would you not do it?
Exactly.
Obviously, I'm preaching to the choir.
Yeah,
you have done it.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I think we have a lot in common because I feel like my career is shaping up to be a lot like yours.
Yeah.
So you kept at it for how long? How long did you really, you didn't retire early at all, did you, Jim? You kind of just, you
no,
did
I,
in
I
and
really
out
didn't.
For...
You know, unless you count, you know, I suppose you
could
make the
argument
that I had a lot of mini retirements, but mm-hmm. I never thought of it in those terms. And so, yeah, I never thought of it as retiring. I guess the most accurate way to think of it is a matter of having a series of sabbaticals.
Yeah.
So,
and then
in fact, when I left my last job, which was the spring of 2011, that was the first time I ever quit a job with the idea that I would never have another.
Yeah.
But in 2011, I would have been 60. So,
mm-hmm.
And here I am with this, you know, I had no idea about it. And I don't suggest this is a good thing by any stretch of the imagination, but when I quit my job, I had no idea what I was going to do in retirement. I didn't have any grand, and you should.
Yeah.
Everything I've ever read about the subject says,
wow.
Have a plan. I didn't. And I wound up by accident starting this blog, and it's made for a wonderful, 4 years.
Wow. Has it been that long?
Yeah. Spring of 2011 and spring of 2015.
So it's kind of been your retirement project. It gives you something to do. It gives you, it's fun, and it, you know, you don't feel like you've got nothing to do, because I feel like you're a busy guy. You've got tons to do, but it kind of gives that backdrop of something to move forward when you don't have anything else to do, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. My biggest complaint about my retirement is I'm just too busy, and that's purely self-inflicted wounds. I mean, it's,
yeah,
you know, and the blog is part of it, because the blog has opened up so many doors and has introduced me to so many interesting people that, you know, it's an embarrassment of riches, if you will, in terms of lifestyle choices. And I really would prefer to have more time doing nothing.
You know, that's a good problem to have, Jim.
I don't think I want to spend all of my time doing nothing,
no.
But I would like to spend a lot more of my time doing nothing than I'm currently spending.
That's a great problem to have.
It is a great problem. As problems go, it is a wonderful problem to have.
Okay. Wow. Well, let's get into some meat and potatoes of your thinking and your experience and wisdom over the years with investing.
Well, can I make one last
sure.
point on retirement that just occurred to me? And
sure.
that is that, you know, as I see some younger people who have become financially independent and have retired, they're in the broader society, there's a real pushback to that. And especially when these people, you know, they reach financial, and they're writing blogs, and they reach financial independence, and they quit their jobs, and then they wind up doing other things, and some of those other things earn money.
Mm-hmm.
And so retirement is kind of a loaded word, and I'm not sure that anybody who is actively engaged with life and healthy and what have you really retires in the sense of they sit around and do absolutely nothing. So maybe retirement, I don't know, maybe retirement needs to be redefined more broadly than it is, or maybe it's not the best word, but
I think so.
Financial independence just means you get to be much more selective about choosing how you want to spend your time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you're not going to spend your time doing things that are interesting and maybe even profitable.
Yeah. You know what my issue is with all that, Jim, is that you're familiar with all the early retirement bloggers and group out there. My issue with that is that I don't feel like you need to get there. I don't think you need to get to 100% financial independence at an age like, let's say, 30, 40 years old, when you're perfectly capable of going out and doing things. What's the odds that you're never going to make another dollar again? Or what's the odds that you want to never make another dollar? So my question is, why do you need to get there? There's all these people just duking it out for 10 more years. You know, they've got a plan for 10 more years to stick it out in the job they hate. I'm thinking, hey, if you got a few years worth of FU money, why stick it out? Why not just jump to the next thing or take some time off like, you know, you did? I don't understand why you'd need to get there. It's great to get there, because then you don't ever have to worry about it again. But really, do you need to get there? Do you need to get to 100% financial independence that early, especially if it comes at such a sacrifice?
You know, I mean, I agree. And as we've already discussed, I certainly didn't wait in terms of stepping away to do other things that I wanted to do, even though I wasn't thinking in terms of being retired.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's there's an awful lot of fear surrounding doing this. And I suppose that, you know, when I stepped away from some of these jobs, there was the possibility that nobody would ever hire me again.
Yep.
But you know, it comes with risk.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way around that. And you don't get to choose to have a risk-free life. The only thing you get to choose is the kind of risk that you want. So do you want to choose staying in a job you hate because it seems less risky, but it's an enormous risk, it seems to me, of ending up at the end of your life saying, holy cow, I could have done much more interesting things than I did. Yeah. And that seems to me to be the bigger risk than
you're right.
Yeah, so it's people just fear different things.
Yeah, Tim Ferriss says,
and it's like people want to buy different things. I'm not one of the bloggers who says in terms of frugality that you shouldn't buy this or you shouldn't buy that or this other thing. I mean, you can buy whatever you want; it's your money.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the most important thing I could buy was financial freedom and. Mm-hmm. Freedom to do things. But somebody else might say, you know, I want a fancy car. That's more important to me than financial freedom. That's hard for me to imagine given who I am, but there are far more people making that choice than making the choice that you and I are making.
So. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, Tim Ferriss says in his book, 4-Hour Work Week, he says if you measure risk by the chance of an irreversible negative outcome, you know, spending 10 years of your life in a job you hate is completely irreversible. You can't reverse that, you know, whereas you take a chance and quit your job and do something else or take 5 years off, you can go get another job again and save more money. That's reversible, but you can't take back years of your life, you know.
Yeah, that's a great point. I you know, that's That book is on my to read list.
Oh, it's so a great one. Especially the beginning. I love the beginning of it. Just awesome.
People keep telling me. I just read his book on, I can't think of the name of it.
Or Chef?
The body book.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
And I was impressed. And I was thinking, I got to read this 4-hour work week because people have suggested it on and off over the years.
I read that about 3 months before I quit my job, so I think it had a pretty good impact on me as far as pushing me over the edge to just do it.
Yeah.
So, same feedback as you just talked about how it's life's too short to be not taking that risk. So.
Well, and I think it's important to realize that staying in a job that you hate, which seems to be what a lot of people choose to do, is every bit as big a risk as moving on.
You're right.
It's just different, right?
You're right. Well, awesome, Jim. So we're on the same page there. And you know what? You impacted me a few years ago, too, because I was saving all this money, putting it in the bank, and then I came across your blog. This is probably where I first heard about you was, I don't know if it was Mr. Money Mustache or where it was, but you talked about index funds in Vanguard, and then you helped me kind of get into that a bunch of years ago and actually helped me push me along and make a little extra money so that I could make this happen. So you're partially responsible for me being here right now.
I thought you were going to say I'm partially to blame.
Well, you could look at it that way, to blame for my craziness.
Let's see how it turns out for you in a few years.
Yeah. Well, that's what I want to talk about today. So, I'd like to get your wisdom for me and for the readers on just give us your perspective on things. There's all kinds of mixed advice out there on investing and where should we put our money, and there's all these so-called professionals out there that we should be handing over the keys to. It seems like there's a lot of, I'm getting this in my personal life. My fiance wants us to go talk to a financial planner or financial advisor that her parents want us to go see because they use them. And I just would like your opinion on what should someone like me do, in this day and age. It's 2015, the market's been going up for 5 years straight. Let's say you're 30 years old, let's take me for instance, got a bunch of money saved. What should I do? Should I be talking to a financial planner or, what do you think, Jim? Give us some of your thoughts.
Well, you've covered a lot of ground just now, and there are a lot of questions embedded in that. So let's start with the financial planner question, because that's seems to be the one that was more front and center in what you were saying. I have a post on my blog about why I don't like financial advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes down to the fact that there is an inherent conflict of interest between what's good for the advisor and what's good for you, the investor.
Mm-hmm.
And it requires the advisor to do what's best for you, requires the advisor to set aside what's best for them. And that requires a fairly saintly kind of person to set aside what's best for them for the benefit of somebody else. And financial management is not a field that attracts saintly people by and large.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure there are a lot of good, honest, ethical advisors out there. The problem is that it's every bit as difficult to find them as it is just to learn how to do it yourself.
Yeah.
Because to be able to evaluate a financial advisor, it seems to me, you have to be pretty financially savvy yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to become financially savvy enough to evaluate advisors, it's a short step to doing it yourself. So Let me talk, before we move on, let me talk just briefly what I mean by that conflict of interest. So advisors make their money basically in one of three ways. They can sell you things that earn them a commission. And you can immediately see the conflict of interest there, because it is in the advisor's best interest to sell you the thing that pays the most commission.
Yep.
That's not going to be the thing that's best for you. But even more importantly, it is in the organization that the advisor works for. It's in that organization's best interest that that advisor do that. So it's not just that the advisor has to overcome their own inclination to do what's best for them. They get fired if they don't. I mean, the companies they work for want them to push the products that they, the company, make the most money on, and that's why they, the company, pay the advisors the biggest commissions.
Now, what kind of products pay commissions?
Oh, load mutual funds, insurance products, many, many number of things. Annuities, and the really disturbing thing about some of these is that the commissions and fees are often buried. I mean, the customer doesn't even see it, and how that's ethical is kind of beyond me, or how that's legal is beyond me. It's clearly it's not ethical, but how it's even legal is beyond me. But that's probably the lobbying power that people selling financial products have. The second way advisors make money is they can charge a fee to manage your money. So they might say, you give me your $100,000 and I'll charge you 1%. 1-2% seems to be typical, and then I'll take care of everything. And it's easy to say, well, 1-2% isn't, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but compounded over time, it is a huge drag on your returns. And if you think about it in terms of, you know, the market, it depends on what period of time you measure, but let's say the market on average returns 8% a year. Well, if you're paying 2% to an advisor, now you're down to 6%. If you're losing 3% of that to inflation, now you're down to 3%. And if you're paying taxes, there's nothing left for you. So when your advisor is only charging a percent or two, they are skimming the absolute cream of your returns off the top. The third way that advisors get paid is on a fee basis. And that's actually, it seems to me, if I were going to go looking for an advisor, this is the best way. And the fee basis simply means that you pay the advisor for that time on an hourly rate. The most ethical advisors that I know embrace this method, but it is a very difficult way for them to do business, quite honestly, because it is much harder for the customer. Customer, you know, human psychology is a bizarre thing, but a customer is much more reluctant to put out $2,000 in hourly fees than they are to pay $10,000 in management fees or commissions that they don't quite see.
Yep.
You know, it's a lot tougher to write the check to your advisor. So advisors, and I, you know, you can't hate them for this, advisors look at it and say, well, wait a second, if I go with a fee basis, I limit the amount of money I can make, because, you know, there's only so much per hour I can charge, even if I get a healthy rate.
Yep.
Second, I probably limit the amount of time that my customer will spend with me, because they're always going to be looking at the clock.
Yep.
And third, customers are more comfortable with, you know, if I were on a commission or a management fee basis where they didn't see it as much. And plus, I make more money that way.
Yep. Makes total sense.
So you
sense.
See, it's a system that's just riddled with obstacles for it being to the benefit of the customer.
Wow. So I guess my question to that, you know, in response is, do we need them? What is it that they're actually providing? What services is that we need from them?
You know, that's an interesting thing, and of course I would suggest that you don't. But let me come back to that, because I'm going to modify my thinking on that a little bit. So one of the when you talk to advisors, and one of the things that I've heard in recent years is kind of a refrain, is that, well, part of the value of an advisor is that when we have a big meltdown, as we did in 2008, and investors are panicking and they want to sell and make all the wrong moves at the wrong time, the advisor is a calming influence. And the advisor can help them not panic sell and help them stay the course, and maybe even encourage them to invest more at these lower bargain prices. And that's the theory. But the truth is that the research I've seen indicates that the advisors were panicking more than their clients. And not just the research, but I have people comment on my blog who say, you know, I got out of the stock market at the bottom in 2008, 2009, because my advisor was saying, we better get out before it goes to nothing. So it depends very much on the advisor that you have. So you have a couple of problems when you're going after an advisor. One is the expenses that we already talked. Two is finding one who knows what they're doing. I mean, a lot of people who call themselves advisors simply aren't competent, which is one of the reasons that to choose one, you need to be fairly financially sophisticated yourself. Mm-hmm. So you've got to find one that's level-headed and competent and that will actually bring value to the table. So do you need one? In my view, investing is very, very simple. I mean, you know, index for research is, and the research has been being conducted now for decades, and it's absolutely clear that indexing is the superior way to go. And a broad-based index fund for stocks is really all you need if you want to accumulate wealth, and it's going to give you the best performance over time of anything you could possibly do.
So, Jim, and then can we?
If you want to smooth, let me just finish the thought. If you want to smooth the ride, then you can buy an index fund for bonds. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, can we back up? Let's dig into this a little bit. Let's pretend that I'm just an average American that really doesn't understand this stuff. And could we back up and just kind of talk about why this is easy? What an index fund is, and so tell me why this is easy as an average American. Why this is easy to invest, and why I don't probably need a financial advisor.
Well, there are certain life situations where you might want to consult an advisor for estate kinds of things,
sure,
and what have you. But just looking at it from a pure investing point of view, right? So investing looks complicated because the financial industry has made it very complicated. And the reason the financial industry has made it very complicated is because the more complicated it is, the more unwilling people are to do it on their own.
Yep.
And the more money they can charge for these various things that they're selling.
Kind of, right? Like taxes.
kind of like taxes. Yeah. I mean, you know, taxes are complicated because Congress is asking the tax code not just to raise revenue, but to influence all these social behaviors that Congress decides are desirable. So the financial industry has a huge financial motivation to make things expensive and complex.
Yep.
That's the bad news. The good news is that for you and me and 99.9% of the people out there, we don't need any of that stuff. So you can look at the table filled with all these financial products and you can put your arm down and sweep them all off and onto the floor. You don't need it. And that's the beauty of indexing. And Jack Bogle, who was the founder of the first index fund, and he didn't come up with the concept, but he refined the concept. And of course, he is the founder of Vanguard, really flew in the face of the financial industry, because what Bogle said was, you know what? we shouldn't be in this business to enrich ourselves. We should be in this business to enrich our customers. And one of the key ways you do that is you make things as inexpensive as possible. And one of the key ways you do that is you make it as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. And, oh, by the way, when you make it simple, you also make it more effective. And when Bogle first came out with this in the 70s, oh my goodness. I mean, he was vilified. I mean, today people still argue. It's amazing to me, after 40 years and countless research papers, people still argue the validity of indexing and the superiority of it. I mean, but they do. You can imagine what it was like when it was just initially a concept.
Wow.
And what the financial industry recognized very clearly is it was a dangerous concept to their bottom line.
Oh, yeah.
Whether they were smart enough and sophisticated enough to realize it was also a superior concept in terms of performance, I don't know. But what they clearly realized is it was going to hurt. If this was adopted, it was going to hurt their bottom line. And the pushback was incredible. And you got to give Bogle credit for staying the course. And his first index fund, it took probably a decade before it really got serious traction. I mean, this was just a concept that was earth shattering.
Sure.
And it was kind of like Newton or Galileo, whoever first definitively proved that the earth rotates around the sun. And I mean, it fundamentally shifted the way people could look at it. And it was not accepted gracefully. So
I bet.
I just went down a tangent. I forgot what your question was. Sorry.
My question was just backing up, you know, talking to the average American on why investing is easy.
Right.
Why is this easy?
So once you've swept everything off the table, what's left is broad-based index funds. And by broad-based, I mean either a total stock market index fund or an S&P 500 index fund. And there are equivalents for bonds. If bonds have a role to play in your portfolio, and that gets into the subject of asset allocation. Mm-hmm. But you're done. I mean, in my world, I own two funds, and I'm done. It's hard for me to imagine it being simpler. And if I were my daughter's age and just beginning, she owns one fund. And she'll own that one fund until she retires. And then she'll add bonds.
All right, so let's back up then. If I'm probably asking this question if I don't know all this already, which is why would I invest in an index fund? Don't I have to pick a certain fund that's going to, I don't know, don't different funds do better, and I got to find the best fund and all, I mean, you know, kind of thinking in terms of actively managed funds, I think that those are the ones that are talked about all the time, where we need to, you know, pick the right fund so that we can get the best return, you know, outpace the market and all this stuff. Is why wouldn't I do that instead of this index fund thing?
Well, the basic reason is because you would pay more money to have the actively managed fund, and at the end of the day, your returns would be lower.
Okay.
So why would you pay more for something that is going to give you a less powerful result?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we...
You know,
go ahead.
I had an interesting... when I first started writing the blog, I started, when I was talking about this subject, I started saying actively managed funds outperformed the index funds. And when I talk about index funds, they're index funds now for lots of different slivers of the market, and that's mm-hmm. not what I'm referring to. I'm referring to broad-based total stock market or S&P 500 index fund. Mm-hmm. There's just so we're clear on that. So index funds outperform actively managed funds 80% of the time, or turn that around, 20% of actively managed funds in a given year have a chance to outperform the index.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, one of my readers challenged me and said, you know, where are you coming up with this number? And it occurred to me that, you know, where I came up with this number is stuff that I've read over the decades, but I haven't really looked at it, and I probably really should look at it. So I went and looked at the current research, and it was eye-opening in that I was being much too generous to the active funds, right? So it's important to understand that if you look at a given year, right, the number of actively managed funds that outperform the index in one given year varies all over the lot. I mean, depends on the kind of year.
Sure.
And have you sometimes, you know, it'll be 40, 50, 60% of actively managed funds that outperform in a year. But investing isn't about what you can do in a year. It's about what you're going to do over decades.
Yep.
Well, when you start looking over decades, Vanguard has had a piece of research that indicated that they looked at 15 years, and I forget that I'm not looking at the research, so I don't have a number, but something like a third of the actively managed funds didn't even survive the 15 years.
Wow.
And they just disappeared. And that percentage might be low, actually. And then of the actively managed funds that survived, 18% outperformed. And of those 18% that outperformed the index over that 15 years, all of them had some really down periods during that 15 years. So you would have had to stick with that actively managed fund while it went through 5-6 years of underperformance before it came back. So it would have been a very difficult ride. Now, there's another piece of research. And again, by the way, if anybody's interested in this, I have links to some of this stuff. If you go on my website and you look at the buttons at the top, there's a button called calculators, actually, but under there's links to some interesting articles and research. But research that looks out 30 years has found that the number of active managers who outperform drops to less than 1%.
Wow.
Less than 1% is a rounding error. As Jack Bogle puts it, it's noise. It's just so much noise.
Wow.
So that's, I mean, that's, you know, that's the answer.
So it just doesn't make any sense to pay the extra fees, which are a ton more in fees, right? I mean, the percentage is ridiculous.
Well, it's, you know, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, the percentages don't sound that bad, as we talked about earlier. I mean, there might be 1% or 0.75% or whatever, but it's when you look at VTSAX, which is Vanguard's total stock market index fund, the annual fee is 0.05%. You know, and actively
managed fund,
the good fee is maybe 0.75%. So, I mean, that's a huge drag over time. The other problem with active managed funds, and I'll give you, because I used to, I mean, it took me a long time to come to indexing. I resisted the idea for probably 20 years.
Wow.
And during the 80s, I was seeking out active managers. And one of the success stories was, for me personally, was a guy named Michael Price. And Michael Price, back in the 80s, he actually ran a couple of mutual funds. They were called the Mutual Series Funds. And Mutual Shares was kind of the flagship of those. And it was a fund that this guy, Michael Price, ran. He ran it very, very successfully. And I forget how I found him, but I found him. And he did for, I don't know, the 5 or 6 years that I owned his fund, he did outpace the index. But then Michael sold his company for $500 million. And this is back when $500 million was real money. And it was interesting. He sold it to Franklin Templeton. And I'm sure it was part of his package in selling the business. He Michael Price, went on a major PR campaign, the gist of which was the fabulous results of that you know you've seen with Mutual Shares, and they were great results, isn't due to me personally. It's this great team I have, and while I'll be moving on, this great team is still in place and nothing will change.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that the problem with that is that it fails to recognize what an incredible anomaly Michael Price was. And one of the smarter things I ever did was say, you know what? I don't think so. And I got out, and of course, mutual shares went to being a very mediocre fund. But now here's the problem. I get out, I have a taxable event, right? I have to pay tax on all those nice gains that Michael generated for me. Mm-hmm. And now I got to go out and find somebody else. And make no mistake, a big part of my finding Michael wasn't great knowledge and skill on my part. It was luck.
Yep.
So now I got to go out and find the next Michael Price. And that's every bit as hard as trying to find the next apple in its yep. nascent stage. So wow. If you go the active route, you not only run a huge chance of picking the guy who's going to underperform, but even if you get lucky enough to pick someone who is, they retire, they change jobs, they sell out, they move on in whatever fashion, and if you're smart, you're going to realize that the fund when who was it? The Rand Magellan, another famous guy. I'm drawing a blank on his name. He's Peter Lynch. When mm-hmm. Peter Lynch was running the Magellan Fund, I mean, he had a great run of outperformance, and Peter became fabulously wealthy doing that, and he retired at a young age, and you know, he and Fidelity made a big big campaign about how nothing was going to change it. It's not just Peter, it was the team. And yeah. Well, Magellan went to being a very mediocre fund. So even mm-hmm. if you pick that rare individual who seems to be able to beat the odds, you know, you're going to have to be able to do that repeatedly.
Yep. Wow, this is good stuff. Yeah. I mean, you convinced me a long time ago when I read that stock series on your blog that index funding was the way to go. Definitely. And by the way, your blog, it's jlcollinsnh.com, right?
Thank you.
you were going to say something? Do you remember what you were going to say?
I just slipped my mind.
So let's, Jim, if you don't mind, let's get into, I want to get your advice on my own situation here. I'm going to be getting married soon, and as listeners know, I've got a decent amount of money saved that I've been saving over the last few years, and now going to get married. And at this point now, I've got enough cash flow for my business, which is, I'm excited to say this, to support me. So I've got all this money.
That's
Yeah, thanks. I've got a decent amount of money. Let's say it's close to $100,000 or so that my future wife and I'll have. What do you advise we do with it? And let me mention this too, that I'm slightly concerned. I'm just an anxious kind of guy. I'm slightly concerned that we're at a market high. You know, I'm kind of kind of afraid to just drop it all into a mutual fund. So, would love your advice on that.
Well, I wrote a post. I think it was 2 years ago. In response to a very similar question, that one of my readers put that they had a lump sum of money they wanted to invest, and the market was at an all-time high, and they were nervous about that. And I wrote a post called "Investing in a Raging Bull," and it could be just as easily called "Investing in a Raging Bear." So,
okay.
As it turns out, when when I wrote that post, I had no idea where the market was going to go. I didn't know if the fear that she was expressing was that we were at an all-time peak, and that could have been. Market could have crashed the moment I published that post. I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Just like I don't know now. As it turns out, of course, the last couple of years, the bull markets continued to roar ahead. I have no idea what it's going to do tomorrow. And nobody does.
Nope.
A lot of people, you can turn on your television and find lots of people who will tell you what it's going to do tomorrow. But none of them know. Some of them, a couple of them will be right simply because there are enough of them out there predicting every possibility.
Yep.
That when the market does whatever it does, somebody will have said that's what it's going to do. And they'll be lionized for a while until they have to make the next prediction. And then they'll get that one wrong. So no, I have no idea if the market, and you can, in that post that I wrote, I have a chart of the market that shows it going back to the beginning of the last century. And you can see all kinds of patterns in that chart. I mean, if you look at the pattern that we've been in for the last, I don't know, 15 years or so, you see a real seesaw kind of thing. And so people could say, well, you know, now it's kind of, you know, it's kind of been high for, it's been going up for the last 5 years, so we're kind of at this peak and inevitably it's going to go down. Well, yeah, maybe you can see that pattern in history, but you could also see a pattern after that seesaw that suddenly it skyrockets and mm-hmm. goes up for 20 years. I don't know. And nobody knows.
Nope.
So the first thing you need to understand is that if you try to time your investing on what the market is going to do, you're going to be paralyzed with fear. You're never going to do anything. And the corollary would be the same if the market was dropping as it was in 2008. And we were talking about advisors who were telling some of them were telling their clients, get out now before it goes to zero. Well, when just as when it's going up, you have no idea how long it's going to keep going up. You have no idea how long it's going to keep going down.
Yeah,
it's easy. I hear people now say, oh, wow, it was such a great buying opportunity in 2008, early 2009. Yeah, it was. I can tell you, having lived through it, most of the smart people that I knew in the beginning of 2009, and the market was at, I don't know, 6,000 or something, the S&P, they saw it going to 2,000. I mean, they saw two-thirds more loss.
Yep.
But they were wrong. If they'd been predicting it a year earlier, they would have been right. You just don't know what the market's going to do.
That's a good point.
What you do know is that over time, businesses who are thriving and competing with each other are going to prosper. And over time, one of the best ways you can invest your money, the single best way historically, is investing in these companies that are striving to build value for their shareholders and to deliver value to their customers and provide value to their employees. It's not going to be a smooth ride. And if you have to have a smooth ride, stocks are not going to work for you. If you're willing to say, you know what, I know that we're at this point here today, and I know that a few decades out, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, we will be much higher, and that's a very safe prediction, unless something that we haven't seen in the last 150 years were to happen. And by the way, in which case, if something of that magnitude were to happen, it wouldn't matter where your money was. Yep. So you're going to see a very jagged line from this point to that point, but at the end of the day, you'll wake up wealthy. What I tell my daughter is, don't even look at it. Just put as much money, you know, you have your basic index fund. It's going to own every publicly traded, virtually every publicly traded company in the most dynamic country and economy in the world. Most of the largest of those companies have extensive international exposure. Mm-hmm. So you will benefit from the growth of the world markets. It'll be a wild ride, but at the end of the day, as you keep putting more money in and more money in, you'll wind up wealthy. And I would also suggest that the best thing that could happen to her and the best thing that could happen to you and maybe a lot of the people who are reading is if the market were to crash. Mm. If you're in the early stages of building your wealth, a market crash is a gift. Imagine if you could go back to 2008 and buy at those prices. For somebody like me, market crash is a little more of a problem, but that's one of the reasons that I hold bonds. And then the other thing to remember is that presumably you're going to be adding to this pile of money. The right psychology, it seems to me, is to invest it and hope the market goes down.
Yeah.
you know, you want the market, and of course the market isn't going to do this for you, but the ideal thing for you is you want the market to plummet the moment you start investing and to keep going down as long as you invest. And then suddenly when you're ready to, when you start earning income and you stop adding new money to your investments, which is where I am, suddenly you want the market to skyrocket.
Yeah.
That's, you know, but while you're adding new money to it, celebrate the downturns.
But that is kind of a concern, if you've got a stash of money that you want to invest now, it's tough. I feel like it would be easier if I didn't have that. If I just had $3,000 a month to invest, I would, you know, I wouldn't care. But about this lump sum kind of thing? You know, what do you do with a lump sum?
But see, you're really talking about psychology rather than reality. So let's suppose that your $100,000 was already invested.
Mm-hmm.
And let's suppose you were starting at the beginning and you put in this amount of money and now you had $100,000 sitting there and the market was high as it is. The market had a number of great years as it has of late. Well, you still have $100,000 employed in the market. And if you're really thinking that way, then you have to think, should I sell? Should I get out?
Yeah.
You know, and do I think it's going to drop? And that's market timing. And boy, if anything has been proven not to work well, it's market timing. It'd be people, you just, nobody successfully does that. I think it's Warren Buffett who makes a great point, and I'll get the numbers incorrect, but talking about the last century, he said, you know, the last century, the markets started at 600 or something, and at the end of the century, it was 11,500.
Mm-hmm.
How does anybody lose money in a century like that? Well, lots of people did, and the way they did is they tried to time the market, as Buffett says, they tried to dance in and out of the market, and that just doesn't work. So even if you had your $100,000 invested because you'd been building it over time, if you let that fear rule you, you still have the same fear.
Yep, you're right. Oh, that's good. So you would recommend that just take the plunge and put it all in, or would you recommend dollar cost averaging, or is that what it's called? Just putting some in at a time, or what would you recommend?
Well, I have a post on dollar cost averaging, and the title of that post is Why I Don't Like Dollar Cost Averaging.
Okay.
So let's talk about. So first of all, to answer your question, yes, if you have money that you want to invest for the long term, and the only way to invest in stocks if you're investing for the long term. So here, let me give a couple of caveats first of all. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to invest in stocks, your mindset, your thinking has to be long term, and by that, you should be thinking in terms of decades.
Okay.
10 years at a minimum. You know, maybe 5 years if you're gutsy. But the further out you go, the more reliably I could say it will benefit you. I don't know, I have any idea what the market's going to do tomorrow or next week or next month or next year. Nobody else does.
Yep.
I'm fairly good bet it'll be up 5 years from now, but a lot of risk in that bet, maybe 50-50. You go out 10 years, and I think that statistics say in any given 10-year period, it's 90% chance it's going to be up.
Mm-hmm.
You go out 20 plus years, I don't think there's ever been a period where the market hasn't gone up over 20 years. So the further out you go, the smoother it is. So you have to think long term. You also have to be, and this is critical, you have to be absolutely certain you're not going to panic and sell. Because if you do, all bets are off. Yeah. If you put $100,000 in, and tomorrow we go into a repeat of 2007, 2008, and you lose half of that money on paper and you sell, then yeah, you've locked in your losses, and nothing in my philosophy or my blog is going to help you. So you have to be sure that you have the internal fortitude to ride through that and take advantage of it by buying more shares.
So really, before I put money in, I should be thinking that I'm not going to need to touch that, or that money's going to stay there for 10 years. So if I plan on using money in the next 10 years, I should probably, or at least 5 for sure, keep it back. in cash?
Or if you're looking, we never got to dollar cost averaging, so remind me, we'll go back to that. But I think that's a good way to think of it. If you're looking at money that you know that you want to invest for 10 plus years, then I'm in the market without a second thought. Mm-hmm. If you're looking, and I would, because I'm a pretty aggressive guy with a pretty high risk tolerance, mm-hmm. I'd probably say 5 plus years.
Okay.
But if you're looking at you know, money you're going to need between now and 10 years, then the sooner you think you're going to need it or want it, the less volatility you want to tolerate, and that means the more cash and the more bonds you want to hold. So, for instance, let's suppose that you said I want to buy a house in 5 years, mm-hmm. and I want to have a down payment. Mm-hmm. The basic recommendation was that's money that belongs in cash and you need to save it in cash, and that means you're going to get almost no return on it, but that's the penalty you pay to have no volatility and to know that you will have that money in 5 years.
Yep.
Now, if you have a little higher risk tolerance and a little more flexibility in whether or not you buy that house in 5 years, you might say, you know what, I'm going to go with 80% bonds and 20% stocks. And that'll give me a better return than cash and with a little more risk. And maybe at the end of 5 years, if things go against me, I won't be able to buy the house right away. I might have to wait a year or two. Yeah. But on the other hand, if things go for me, maybe I can buy it in 3 or 4 years.
So I'm totally all right with that.
Maybe if you're bolder, you say, I'm going to go with 50-50. You know, yeah. I mean, it depends on your... So when you're in that 10-year time frame, a lot of it depends on your risk tolerance.
Would you mind touching on the bonds thing, Jim? Because I really don't understand why. Now, why would I want to do partially bonds? How does that help me in this case?
Well, bonds tend to be less volatile than stocks. And so bonds tend to smooth the ride. And bonds also tend to go, and I'm using the word tend because none of this is carved in stone. Bonds also tend to go in different direction, mm-hmm. as stocks. So if your stocks are going down, your bonds are going to hold up better. So that's the thinking there. So for instance, now that I am I'm in what I call the wealth preservation stage, where I'm no longer earning money and I'm no longer building my wealth and I'm no longer, mm-hmm. adding to my investments for my earned income. So when you're adding when you're in the acquisition phase, mm-hmm. what I call the acquisition phase, which is where you are right here. So you're still working, you're making more money, you're adding money to your investments. Mm-hmm. So we've already discussed how the stock market is going to give you the best return over time, but it's going to be a wild ride.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that you're adding money to those investments, assuming you're not panicking, helps smooth that ride, because when it drops, and this goes back to what I was saying,
that you're buying cheap.
Anybody building wealth should welcome drops. It allows you to buy these shares at bargain prices. Now, when you're in my situation, bonds provide that smoothing effect that your additional income and investing does when you're in the acquisition phase, right? Mm-hmm. So I have my bonds, and if the stock market were to plummet, then the percent that stocks represented in my portfolio would go down compared to bonds, and I could sell some of the bonds, buy some of the stocks at a cheap price. So
okay.
I could take advantage of the drops in that fashion.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I was just wondering like how that would work with me if I'm going to buy a house in 5 years, and therefore I'm going to take 50 grand and put it partially in bonds and partially in stocks. I just wanted to understand right. that. Okay.
Yeah. And to be clear, bonds are not without their risks though. And, mm-hmm. and you know, again, I have a post in my stock series that is devoted to bonds, and it talks about the risks, and there are several different, I don't know that we could spend a whole hour just talking about bonds.
No, that's fine.
And it's not a very interesting subject, but if anybody's interested, if they go on the blog, they can find a post about it and and that it outlines it.
Yeah.
What okay. they are and how they work and what the risks are involved in bonds.
Great. Let's.
You know, it's it goes back. You know, Craig, in a way, it goes back to what we were talking about in terms of lifestyle, right? So, if you have money, and you know, that's a nice problem to have is having money, but having money is a problem, and you cannot have money without having risk. I mean, you don't get to, if you have money. You know, you mentioned you have $100,000. If you have $100,000, by definition, you have risk associated with that money. You don't get to choose. You don't get to say, I don't want to have any risk with my $100,000. Mm-hmm. That's not an option that you have. Just like you don't get in your life to say, I don't want any risk.
Yep.
The only choice you have is what risk do you want? And really what that comes down to is what kind of volatility are you willing to tolerate? So what do I mean by that? Well, we've already discussed stocks. Stocks, if you look out 20 plus years, are very low risk. I mean, you're almost, unless the world completely upends, in which case it doesn't matter what you're invested in, you're almost guaranteed to be wealthier by virtue of owning stocks. But it's volatile getting there from here to there. Not risky, because it's hard to say it's risky if you can say with almost certainty 20 years from now you'll be wealthier.
Yep.
If you look at cash, most people say, well, cash is, if you want a risk-free investment, it's cash. Well, no. If you want an investment with low volatility, then, which is what you want if you're going to need the money in 5 years for your house, then cash is a great thing. But you're going to earn less than 1% or about 1% if you're lucky, and maybe a little more than 1% these days if you're aggressive and look for some opportunities on your cash. If inflation's running at 3%, at the end of 20 years, you will have a guaranteed loss in not necessarily in dollars, but in spending power. So you look at stocks, which are hugely volatile, but are almost guaranteed to make you wealthier in 20 years, and you look at cash that has almost no volatility, but is absolutely guaranteed to make you poorer in 20 years. Where's the risk? Well, in a short term like 5 years, volatility is the greater risk. In a longer term like 20 years, then cash losing money, a little bit of money, you know, cash losing a little bit of money to inflation for 5 years, not a big deal. For decades, very big deal.
I think that's...
Does that make sense? Or
yeah,
is that
just makes total sense. Yeah, that kind of helps me.
So you don't get to choose. Yeah, you don't get to choose not having risk. You just get to choose what kind of risk fits your needs.
I like that. Awesome. Well, let's quickly hit on the if you want to hit on the dollar cost averaging thing, and then then we'll probably wrap it up, because this has been great, Jim. This has been great.
Well, thank you. So dollar cost averaging. Again, I have a, if anybody's interested, I have a post on the blog that talks about this in some depth. But basically what dollar cost averaging is it says, you know, it's designed to address exactly the concern you're expressing with your $100,000. So with dollar cost averaging, they would say, well, the risk is if you put the $100,000 in all at once, then you might wake up tomorrow and the market's down 20%. And that'd be a very bad day for you. And we could all agree, yes, that would be a very bad day for any of us that did that. So instead of doing that, you dollar cost average. And what that means is you take your $100,000 and you divide it up into even chunks of money. Let's say $10,000. So 10 chunks of $10,000. And maybe over the next 10 months, you put $10,000 a month into the market until the whole $100,000 is deployed. And that way, if something bad happens, then, you know, the next month your $10,000 is buying those shares at the lower price and it evens out and you've mitigated the risk. That's the theory.
Yep.
So why don't I like it? Well, I don't like it for a couple of reasons. One is it assumes that in that 10-month period or 20-month period, if you did $5,000 a month or whatever period you choose, that the market's going to go down.
Yep.
And of course, there's no guarantee the market's going to go down. It might continue to go up, in which case you have simply paid progressively more money for your shares for each of your $10,000 units. So there's no guarantee that it is going to give you a better result. Second reason I don't like it is that while the market could plunge tomorrow when you the day after you invest your $100,000 or even in the year after you invest it, the truth is the market goes up much more often than it goes down.
Yep.
In fact, the market goes up, I think, you're looking at it, and again, I'm testing my memory, but on a month-to-month basis, the market goes up about 72% of the time, as opposed to, 28% of the time. Mm-hmm. So 72% of the months, the market goes up, and 28% of the months, it goes down on average. So the odds are very much higher that the market's going to go up. And of course, you only benefit from dollar cost averaging if, in fact, the market goes down.
That's good.
And then the third thing is that at the end of your 10 months, let's suppose the market goes up. And so, 10 months, every month, your $10,000 is buying you fewer shares because they're more expensive. At the end of 10 months, you have $100,000 invested and you have exactly the same risk you were afraid of. What if the day you put that final $10,000 in, the market plunges by 50%?
Mm-hmm.
So you've pushed the risk out, but you haven't mitigated it at all. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right. By the same token, let's suppose the market goes down steadily for 10 months. Mm-hmm. Well, at the end of that time, you're still at the bottom. And, who knows where it goes from there?
You're right.
So anyway, that's why I'm not a fan. Now, having said all of that, if it allows you to sleep better at night, there's something to be said for sleeping better at night.
Yeah,
but you need to understand that if you do that, you're adjusting your financial decisions to your psychology. And if you read through my stock series, one of the recurring themes is that you are better off adjusting your psychology to the realities of how investing really works.
I like that. Great. Well, thanks so much, Jim. This has been a blast, and I learned a lot.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. I enjoy the conversation.
Yeah. So where can listeners learn more? Your stock series is awesome.
Well, you already were nice enough to mention the blog, which is JL Collins NH. So that's my first two initials, JL. Mm-hmm. The last name Collins, which is Collins, and NH is for New Hampshire because all the versions of my name were taken when I went for the blog. So the NH stands for New Hampshire. So it's jlcollinsnh.com. And then when the blog opens up, you'll see a series of tabs across the top. And one of them is the calculator tab where I list a bunch of various financial calculators that I've referred to in the posts, in the various posts. And also in there are links to some of the studies that we talked about. And then there's a link for what my blog is best known for, which is the stock series, which is a series of, I think it's 28 posts now.
Wow.
And it walks people through how the stock market really works and what the risks really are and what you need to be aware of and what you need to be prepared to deal with if you want to take advantage of the incredible wealth generating potential it has. And it is truly incredible. But as we've talked about, you have to be willing to you have to recognize that you can't possibly predict the short term or time the market.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to be willing to accept that periodically you're going to wake up and see that the market's dropped, 10, 20. I mean, I tell my daughter, who's in her early 20s, she'll see at least one, maybe two financial meltdowns of the caliber that we saw in 2008. That's another point, if I can.
Sure.
I know you're trying to wrap this up, but an incredibly important point, I think, is that I try to convey in the blog is that stock market corrections, and a correction is a 10% drop.
Okay.
Bear markets, which is defined as a 20% mark, crashes, which are 30, 40, 50 plus percent mark, these are normal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this should not be a reason to panic, even though the general media and financial world will be panicking when, you know, when it happens. These are absolutely normal. They're part of the process. They're never going to go away. It's like thunderstorms. I mean, you shouldn't be terrified or surprised with the occasional thunderstorm. I mean,
yeah,
that happens. And it's the same with the stock market. If you're going to invest, you just have to know what's going to happen, and you just have to be willing to say, you know what, here we go, and we'll come at the other end, the world is, everybody's going to be predicting the world's going to end, and they're going to be wrong.
Go down in the basement and take cover, and then come back up when it's over.
Or just don't pay any attention.
Yeah.
Just go on with your life. Yeah, that's another thing about investing, and I think sometimes the people like my daughter who are not really interested in this stuff are the people who will do the best. Because they don't obsess about it, and they don't make themselves crazy. People who have a layman's interest in it, and like me, who pay attention to what the market's doing, you know, we're the ones who tend to get caught up in the fear mongering or the euphoria on the other side of it.
Yep.
You know, if you've got better things to do with your life, if you get a couple of things right, you know, that is, you buy a broad-based stock index fund and you have a high savings rate and you add to it, come hell or high water, as regardless of the market does, you know, you wake up rich in a few decades. But if you obsess about it and you get terrified and you say, oh, the market's going down, I better get out, or I better not invest because the market's up or whatever, you know, that's, so it, you know, great irony of investing is simpler, is more powerful, and in some ways, the less attention you pay to your investments, not in some ways, categorically, the less attention you pay to your investments and the more you ignore them and let them grow, the better results you'll get.
Yeah, that's probably the piece of advice that's the most relevant to me. That's definitely what I need to do. Yeah. I tend to go a little crazy and just overly pay attention and, you know, freak myself out and all that, so... to my detriment.
Well, it really is. I mean, once you accept the brilliance that was Jack Bogle's concept of indexing, and you sit back and you say, wow, I mean, this is not just an idea that makes logical sense, but there's, you know, it made logical sense back when he first came up with it as a grad student in the 50s, and then he refined it over the decades and then launched it as Vanguard, and now there's 40 years of it in operation, research that just, it leaves certainly every stock picking strategy or every, you know, every actively managed mutual fund in the dust. So.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. Thanks again, Jim. And
my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. I've enjoyed it.
You bet. Everybody check his blog out, jlcollinsnh.com. All right, so that was the interview. I hope you enjoyed it. I know there were some darn good nuggets in there, nuggets of wisdom. And like I said, Jim is he's kind of like my investing, my personal finance father, really. I look up to what he says in this stuff. So hope you enjoyed it and got some value out of it as well. I know I sure did. And that wraps it up for this episode. Just want to tell you guys, have a great week. And if you do like the show, if you maybe just found us recently, if you like the show, could I ask you to please head over to createmyindependence.com/iTunes and just leave an honest review of what you think of the show. It really helps us and it really helps the show. Okay, that's it. Have a good week, and I'll talk to you soon.